Hey, Brendan.
Hello, Alan and Jürgen.
Hello, gentlemen.
Episode 227 of the Not a Thing podcast is up and running. This fine day.
Is it
evening, morning, night? I remember having this discussion with Brendan once about how I especially frequently comment on the time of day that we're recording, and yet it doesn't matter because A, we don't post it the same day that we record, and B, people can listen to it whenever they want, so it's not necessarily, you know, day or night or what have you. So I don't know. It's
time is a flat circle.
Amen.
Well, we're going to be talking about lots of stuff today. We're going to be entering spoiler territory extra early this episode. I think we have all of one non-TV and movie related topic this week, and it's, I don't think it's for lack of trying. There's been a lot of stuff that's been going on the last 2 weeks, you know, with the Facebook testimony, and now apparently Paul Ryan is not renewing his speakership. There's all sorts of stuff going on.
The death of attorney-client privilege.
and Michael Cohen has been recording conversations and keeping the tapes in his office.
Oh, man. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff. We may need like a week to kind of percolate on some of those topics, and we'll see what we can shake out for next week. But if you have ideas about what you'd like to be on the show, or if you yourself would like to be on the show, we have been in need of a guest for a while. I'm going to start like asking like friends and strangers and people on my classes, like, hey, you want to be on our podcast? Because if you would like to be on our podcast, please let us know. Tweet at us, Facebook us, find us wherever you find us out in the real world, and say, hey, I have a thing, or I have a not thing that you might want to talk about, or maybe you would like to be on the show with us. We've not had a guest since transitioning to this three-host format. I think it might be challenging to have that many people on the show at once, but I feel like we've done it, haven't we?
We've had more than that. I think six people at once.
Wow.
Or five. I think it was five.
Yeah, I think it was five. Yeah. That's a lot of people.
And that was with us all in the same room.
Right.
It would be interesting to try it remotely with four different people.
We can certainly give it a try. So if you'd like to be on the show, please let us know. Again, we're at Not a Thing Cast on Twitter and on Facebook at notathingpodcast.com. Also on the internet. So without further ado, let's jump into topic one, which really comes out of, honestly, some enlightened self-interest here, because something that happened this week was that I got invited to configure my Tesla Model 3. Yay! Ooh. I've been talking about this for a little while, maybe not on the show, but certainly in real life, that I got in line to put the deposit down for the Model 3 sight unseen. So that was either brave or foolish or both. And I finally got the configuration notice. So sometime in the next 3 to 6 weeks, we're going to try and record a show in the car. It's going to be a thing. We're going to give it a try. But in the meantime, one of the things that I've been reading up on a lot, and one of the things that we'd probably be talking about even if I weren't buying a Tesla Model 3, is the idea of self-driving cars. And not that that idea is a thing, or if it's not, because certainly it's coming. I mean, we've talked about it a lot on the show in the past. But one of the things that is not a thing yet is the regulations around those self-driving cars. Regulations around the cars are kind of governed by a couple different boards: the National Highway Transit and Safety Administration, the National, the NTSB, which I can never remember what that stands for. I think it's National Transit and Safety Board. So they have a Transit Highway and Safety Administration and a Transit Safety Board. So there's already some, I don't know exactly what's going on there, but the thing
that... Bureaucracy?
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly a thing that shouldn't be a thing. But in any case, the bits that I've been noticing from what I've been reading is that the regulatory environment around just cars in general is pretty built in, and it's based around things like how fast can a car stop, what are the minimum standards for braking distance, the clearances for crumple zones, things like that. That's all stuff that's been codified, but it's all built around the assumption that you are going to own your car, and not about cars that you're necessarily not going to own, which is encompasses all sorts of things. So this is rideshare, as well as driverless cars. So cars where there isn't a driver at all. And those kinds of things have or should have kind of a different regulatory environment around them. What's interesting right now is that because it is an unregulated environment, it is kind of the Wild West in terms of companies doing mostly whatever they want without kind of recompense. But the there is also kind of a, because it is state by state, the other effect that's happening is kind of a race to the bottom in terms of the regulatory environments, because the one with the most permissive regulatory environment is where the big companies are going to be spending their tax dollars as they're testing. So that's one of the reasons that, quite unfortunately, Arizona was where that accident occurred. And I don't think we talked about it on the show, but there was a driverless car, or a car that was testing driverless software for Uber.
It was fairly driverless, considering the person who was driving it was on her cell phone at the
time. Well, yeah, right. So for quote-unquote safety, which apparently horrifically failed in this case, it ended up hitting a woman who had run or had jogged her bike into the street. And they released the dash cam footage, and it is kind of sudden that she comes out into the street and the car ends up hitting her. But at the same time, I've read two counter arguments around that. The first one is that the camera has cameras are notoriously bad at low light. And so it's possible that like a human could have seen the person crossing into the street before the camera did. So that's point one. But point two is that if the car were as full of sensors as it was meant to be, so the cars have their own cameras that they see with, that in theory see beyond the visual range, so they can see in infrared and ultraviolet or whatever they can see. In addition, there is supposed to be radar or LIDAR that is attached to the cars for sensing. And yep. So in theory, the car should have seen the person crossing into the street. So... And that's really the selling factor of autonomous driving, is that the car's AI and kind of computer sensing and vision are supposed to be better and more consistent than a human's would be. But in this case, both kind of failed. And so that is, I mean, A, super duper unfortunate, right? Someone actually died from an autonomous vehicle. And it puts to rest a lot of the kinds of ideas around like what would a car do, and apparently the car is still dependent on the person, and when the person isn't looking either, that's what happens. So part of it is, from a regulatory point of view, how do you kind of regulate a system that is constantly changing? And then from a just kind of safety point of view, what is the minimum kind of standard for things while things are being tested? And it is a kind of complex environment, because often regulations move slower than than the technology that's related, right? Yep. I mean, you can, we can, this is where we bring up the Facebook,
yes.
Facebook, kind of statements. Mark Zuckerberg was in this week, yesterday and today, I believe, giving testimony regarding the Cambridge Analytica stuff, which if you look at the episode here, you can listen to about, as we talked about on the podcast. Actually,
226, I believe.
That was, yeah.
Yes, that was it. Right. There we go. And, you know, it's sort of hilarious to have Mark Zuckerberg, the CEO of Facebook, being grilled by Congress. And if you listen to any of the videos or read any of the transcripts, it's bad. It's like, it would be great if someone who actually knew how Facebook worked were asking the questions about Facebook.
Yes, because Chuck Grassley's VCR is still blinking blue. Midnight. I think the whole autonomous vehicles landscape is so complex, because there are five levels of autonomous driving, ranging from level one, which is lane assist, or like automatic braking, where your car keeps distance from the car ahead of you and stays within the lane that it's supposed to stay within.
I've actually heard that is level two, and level one is just straight up cruise control.
All right. And level five is where you can watch a movie on your iPad while the car just does the driving and you don't have to pay attention at all. Just tell it where tell it where you want to go, and it takes care of the rest. And with so many different companies now operating on this, towards the same goal, but in different technologies and not cooperating with each other, in fact, actually competing and stealing technology from each other. I'm right. Looking at you, Uber.
Yes, Uber again in this.
And then you have different states with different mandates and different approaches to all of this, not to mention different countries, because China, there's over a billion people in China, and they have just a totally different relationship to technology and privacy. So every research article that I read says that proper artificial intelligence and robotics and everything is going to come from China first, because they create so much more data and so much better data, because it's being run and tested with people at the same time as the US is holding back a little bit. So I think you'll see, and also you're seeing companies trying to do the same thing as Waymo and Uber and Tesla, coming out of China practically every week. And then a company like Waymo, who they ordered, I think it was 20,000 Jaguars to be delivered in 2020, and they are meant to be driving autonomously. So Alexis Madrigal, who writes for Wired and The Atlantic on technology, had a little tweet storm about this and an article about it the other day in The Atlantic, which is, he says, I don't think people grasp the significance of the Waymo announcement about their order for a fleet capable of doing a million trips per day. They're basically saying they expect to drive more miles each day in 2020 than they have total up to this point. And 2020 is like a year and a half away.
Yeah.
Which they're basically signaling scale of autonomous driving in the next 18 to 24 months, which is how fast that's going to be. And it doesn't look like technology companies are going to wait for the policymakers to sort this stuff out, which I think is a little worrying. And it's kind of also interesting to try to like guess what does, because Waymo have not had an accident. Tesla, every now and then you read about a Tesla accident, and there was a Tesla fatality 2 weeks ago as well, I believe, in the That's same right. week as the Uber one. Mm-hmm. And Tesla came out and said that the driver was not paying attention. And the driver of the Uber car was definitely not paying attention. But the Waymo, as far as I know, have not had a scandal like this. So it could be that they are miles ahead of the competition.
Or it could be that they're not releasing that information. I mean,
or that could be.
That's another kind of aspect of this discussion, is that the car companies are not under any or they're not even car companies, right? These aren't the car. No. These are the car operators.
Yes. Right?
And so the car operators aren't under any kind of regulations to release information about the crashes that they have been in.
Right.
They are, for the most part, cooperating with the governing agencies regarding the existing governing agencies regarding when the crashes occur. But it's mostly, at least from what I've seen, the way that the language is kind of couched is more of a, like, it wasn't my fault kind of thing. It's right. Not that they're trying to figure out what happened in order to make that not happen again. It's more to make sure that we can assign the blame not to the car, which I find is distressing, right? Because you want, if you're riding in a car, or if you're, you know, hit by a car, there's someone at fault in this. And, you know, the responsibility has to, you know, kind of land somewhere. And so the article that I'd found, and we'll link to it in the show notes as well as that, the tweet thread that you were talking about, Jurgen, is really saying and calling for not necessarily regulations in order to slow things down, because the idea should be that because these companies are trying to essentially get to the same goal, generating data that actually helps the other companies would be useful. So one of the ideas for regulation was to, whenever there is any kind of crash, to immediately you know, be able to publish the information that came out of it in order to kind of better assess the idea. And then the other thing, which I thought was interesting, was to have investigators specifically for autonomous vehicle kind of certification, because the idea about the certification of vehicles currently is, again, that idea that your car will perform in a certain way, but it doesn't have any ideas about, like, what happens when there's a lot of traffic, what happens if the maps are incorrect, what happens if the cameras don't work, because that's not something that you keep track of in a normal car right now.
No.
And so that's the kind of thing that has to be kind of looked at and advanced.
Do you think that it's possible that in China they could leverage the massive surveillance state apparatus that's over there to hook into any sort of autonomous car system?
Easily.
I mean, that's a fantastic idea for it, right? Because if you see the
internet in China is much more linked to the states. It's partially controlled and run by the state, along with this personal karma system. And I mean, pretty much any company down there needs to operate with open data for the government and have the access by the government into their data sets and everything. So I think that's definitely a thought. The US, I'm surprised that the insurance companies aren't more heavily out in the open here, because they are the ones who are going to be left with a giant pile of dog shit on their front lawn either way, because they are currently the ones designing the old system. And it seems to me that they're partially clinging to the old system, where they should be much more in the out in the open, pushing for legislation and pushing for new policies to sort this out and come up with suggestions. And they're surprisingly quiet in this field.
Interesting. And we've definitely talked about it on the show before, how it's going to be the roughest in this transition period, as there exist people with the different levels of that automation that are out there. I mean, because the main thing that I took away from the level 5 level of automation was that the cars, in order to do that, the cars have to talk to each other, right? And if the cars have to talk to each other, they have to have some like kind of common understanding of what is safe and what is that. And currently there is no, it seems like there's no movement towards that. And that is one of the biggest things to get over, I think, because if it's not like we're going to go and then, or it seems like it's operating in the same way that kind of, well, frankly, you know, technology goes with phones and computers and whatnot. And it's like, whichever one is the dominant platform in terms of who has the most market share, that becomes the de facto standard, right? Windows was the de facto standard. Like, you don't do documents unless it's in Word. That kind of fell away and turned into PDF a little bit to some degree. But it's that idea of like, let's not have things that interoperate. And that's really like a recipe for things breaking, in my opinion. So hopefully, hopefully we won't have this issue and we'll be able to record our show. And maybe I can even, you know, with my hands on the wheel and still keeping situational awareness, run with a little bit of autopilot so we can record a little bit of the show.
Yeah, I've only experienced the part of the autopilot in Tesla where it stays within the lanes while the driver was holding onto the steering wheel. But I mean, already then, actually, we rented a Volkswagen Golf last summer in Norway, and it had that kind of
lane centering.
Yeah, lane centering, and also like measuring the distance to the cars ahead of you. So we were driving in the fast lane.
Traffic at a set speed. Adaptive cruise control.
You nerd! And then whenever a car would drive in ahead of us in the lane, it would slow down and keep them the distance measured to it. And when they went out of it again, it sped up to the cruise control. So that stuff is nice. The adaptive cruise control stuff, I like that.
Yeah, the feature I'm most looking forward to with that is a traffic adaptive cruise control, because it can go all the way down to zero, the way I understand it. So in true stop and go traffic, it will just handle that. And that is one of the like most like freeing things for me. I mean, I don't drive a whole lot. I say that just before I start driving again to Mountain View on that, my 45 to hour long commute for 20 miles. But, it is something that I'm looking forward to. So we'll see about that. Let's see. I think that is actually our only, non-entertainment topic this week. It was sort of entertaining though, I hope. Hopefully you do find the podcast entertaining, even when we're not talking about entertainment, quote unquote. But we are moving over a little bit. I don't think we're moving quite into spoiler territory. We do try and keep it mostly light, but we are talking about TV and movies kind of from here on out. The first thing that I wanted to talk about, and I know Yurian, you wanted to talk about it, is the TV show Atlanta, which is in its second season. It's about halfway through its second season right now. And the last episode for it kind of just blew my mind a little bit. It's without kind of going into it, the main thing that I love about this show, and it's written and directed in part by it was created by Donald Glover, right? And so it's really interesting and funny in that way. I mean, he was a writer for 30 Rock and of course Community as well. But what is that? That seemed
no, that a good it's in memory of one of my favorite shows.
Oh, okay, okay. Years. But yeah,
I love Community.
He has that. He has, you know, certainly the writer's wit, and it's there, and it comes out in the show. But I think the thing that is most amazing to me about the show is that it is so different episode to episode. It really doesn't, I mean, there's threads and there's certainly characters that persist, all of their characters kind of persist in this world, but it is a somewhat surreal just kind of in general, and then episode to episode they can be wildly different. Like the most recent episode is almost like a horror episode, and the one just before it is like just this like laugh riot of a day that this person
fantastically
has.
Fantastically funny.
Yeah. And so
it's absolutely hilarious.
So it's a very kind of bold show in that I think if you are expecting kind of a kind of consistent experience from your TV watching, it may be kind of off-putting, I think. But I think that that kind of interestingness and quirkiness is what really draws me to the show.
And I think the first season, I watched the whole first season. My wife fell off kind of halfway, but I watched the whole first season, and I was mesmerized by it, but I couldn't tell you why.
That's a really,
like, I really enjoyed it, but I tried to explain it to other people, and I tried to tell people why I thought I enjoyed it, or at least it was like watching something completely different. And they have a main character, and they have a set of secondary characters around him, and
Paperboy.
there's something developing in his story, and also from season one to two, he's becoming more famous and getting some more traction and everything. And there are, I don't know, but the it is still a little hard to pinpoint exactly why I enjoyed the show. And then I read a ton of articles around Mr. Glover before season two started now, and it was all about like, this is the show that African Americans can properly identify with, and it talks about what it is like to be and live in Atlanta and in the South, and racism and all these topics. And I'm not sure that I'm picking up on all of those, which should only come naturally, being a white man born and raised in Norway. But I like that it appeals to different people for different reasons. I think that's quite a major feat. And it is unlike anything on TV today. And as you say, the two last episodes are absolutely fantastic for completely different reasons. They actually don't even have any of the same characters in them.
Well, they sort of do. Yeah.
By phone only. Yeah, right. Like they follow two different groups of the main team of characters.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they're like short movies, but yeah.
But I think it's just they're all really, really tight. I mean, first of all, they're 30-minute episodes for the most part. 30 to 40-minute episodes. And so
50 in the last one.
But so yeah. They're very constrained from that point of view. So they have to be really kind of tightly written and tightly edited, and they are. They're really well done from that kind of perspective. And then they have an interesting balance of humor, because there is always that kind of humor that is behind there, but it's not funny because of necessarily a setup or a situation. It's more kind of the overall kind of feel of it, and it's like, oh yeah, that's, I would laugh there too.
Yeah.
Kind of, yes. an effect, even though it's not necessarily a like out and out funny situation. It is really hard to describe as a show. And I mean, because it is like, you almost don't want to give any of it away when you're telling people about it. You kind of want to just let people experience it and then get what they like out of it.
Yeah.
But everyone that I've talked to that has started watching it has stuck with it, and so I'm trying to slowly build a crew of people that I can talk to about the episodes.
Well, now I feel like an asshole. I only finished half the first season.
You are like my wife.
Funny enough, I was watching it with my girlfriend, and we stopped watching it.
I wonder if there's a common episode, because I'm thinking back into halfway through that season, and I'm wondering where the breakpoint was, because there are a couple episodes where, I mean, the like we were saying, the episodes are kind of different in tone a little bit, about about each episode, and so
It is the show that I pretty regularly say, hey, maybe we should finish that, and then it never happens. So I might have to go rogue on this one and just catch up.
Go nuts.
So I don't have as much to add on the current season of Atlanta. I will just add in, FX is doing really interesting things as a network.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. I am caught up and watching the newest season of Legion, which if you have not watched the first season, check it out. It's amazing. And the season premiere of season 2 was the most bizarre piece of television I've ever seen. And I loved it. It is very psychedelic. It's just so weird.
Interesting, because that's how I feel sometimes after watching Atlanta. So, okay.
Maybe and I'll... isn't, correct me if I'm wrong here, but isn't Legion show-runned, if that's an expression, by Noah Hawley? The guy behind Fargo?
It is.
Which is majestic.
Mm-hmm.
And it has the same production designer as Pushing Daisies.
Oh, you're speaking my language now.
Exactly.
One of my all-time favorite canceled shows.
Yes. I was watching the season premiere, and I was like, this is amazing. Like, this is beyond what you see on TV and beyond what you see in most movies in quality. And I was like, who did the production design on this? Oh, it's that guy. Whose name I don't remember right now.
Thank God you don't remember his name. But it is... That is a very, very notable notice. Well done. I like.
It is. It's amazing. It's very. There's a whole in the premiere. I'm not giving anything away. There's a dance battle that is completely devoid of dialogue. That is just mesmerizing.
Interesting.
Do I need to watch the whole first season first?
Absolutely.
Okay.
That's what I've heard too. Yeah, I haven't.
Yes, sir.
It is very like it's very complex show because you have the main character is potentially schizophrenic, and so there's a lot of stuff that happens on the show that you're not sure whether it's happening in real life
or if old, the show is happening in narrator. Real life. Yeah,
yeah, it is. It's impressive, and it's a technically a Marvel show. So, yeah, no, it is. If there's a show that you need to be watching that's not Atlanta on TV right now,
fine.
Yeah, we say in the 2 weeks before Westworld starts back up. Let's just say that.
Ooh, yeah,
I think Legion is better than Westworld.
Okay.
Do you want to talk about spoiler territory on Westworld?
No, we don't. We don't want to do that. We don't want to do that.
You had me for a while there because I was like, really? Did he fall for that? What an idiot. And then I was like, oh no, he's goading us into watching it. No, I'm sorry. I get it. I get it.
I still haven't watched it.
I get it.
You should watch it. You should watch it. But maybe
it gives
something
everything away.
Let's move over to something maybe you shouldn't watch. We're going to move.
Nice segue, man.
We're not supposed to talk about him, remember?
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. Edit that out and we'll fix it in post.
We'll always
talk about him.
Let's move over to the movie Pacific Rim, which I think at least two of us have seen.
Rim Uprising. Alan.
Pacific Rim Uprising. You're right. It's
going to be a very different conversation if we're talking about the first Pacific Rim,
aka Pacific Grim. Fix that in post too. I don't care.
Yeah, maybe not.
Leave it in.
Pacific Rim Uprising. I saw it. I think I saw it premiere weekend with Julie. So. That was more her choice than mine. I did like the first movie quite a bit, but I knew the second one was a little odd because it had no one from the first movie, essentially.
No, it had one of the main characters.
Oh, you're right.
One
you're
of
right.
the three.
You're right. Okay.
Granted, she's not in it that much.
No.
But she's in it. And two of the supporting characters. Okay. But you got a Scott Eastwood. All so... Right. I think I feel like that balances out.
Okay. But it's a movie that checks all the boxes for, you know, is it are there giant robots? Do they fight other giant robots? And do they fight kind of big alien things? It's like, yes, all of those three things. That's Pacific Rim Uprising. If you like those things from Pacific Rim, you will probably like those things also from Pacific Rim Uprising.
I think you will only like about 6 minutes of Pacific Rim Uprising, because there was only about 6 minutes even of the giant robot monster fights.
There are less of them. Yeah.
That I feel like captured the level of the first movie. I had read a few years back about what the potential script was for the sequel, and that's the movie they basically made, and it was bad. It was real bad. I was... Everything that could go wrong, I feel like went wrong. Like, the first movie takes place almost entirely at night in the rain.
Mm-hmm.
Which, from a visual standpoint, makes so much sense, because you have all these giant CGI things, and it looks cool, and it covers up how fake everything looks, because everything's dark.
Mm-hmm.
This entire movie takes place during the day.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
It is glaring how it's like, looks like action figures.
Yeah.
It doesn't look... just did not
work. It's 100% a CGI fest, which is something that I'm noticing more and more as something that I just can't be down with anymore. But
I think I'm getting John Boyega fatigue as well.
What?
Yeah. I don't know how much of his part they actually wrote. It felt like he was just improvising through most of the movie, being funny.
How many movies have you seen with him in?
Like four?
Four? And you didn't even see the tort, huh?
No. I did not. But I felt like in...
A little early for fatigue.
Pacific Rim Uprising and in the Star Wars movies, he plays the same character.
Oh. So you're saying lack of width, breadth.
Yes. His first movie, Attack the Block, I loved.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I thought he was excellent in that. I even enjoyed his character for the most part when The Force Awakens came out. But now that I've seen three movies where he plays pretty much the same character.
Mm. So you are ready for the John Boyega romantic comedy.
That might just be the end of it.
Nice.
Well, another kind of in that, I don't know, it's not exactly CGI fest, but it's an animated kind of movie. It was Isle of Dogs, which I saw today. It's the new Wes Anderson film, which is about a boy trying to find a dog, and the dogs can talk and they help him. And it's very Wes Anderson-y, which is both good and bad, right?
Well, it depends on if you like Wes Anderson.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
And I think it definitely fits the kind of awkward quirkiness that comes out of a lot of the Wes Anderson films. The one thing that that was kind of in my mind, and I like to say it was in the back of my mind, but no, it is in the front of my mind in this in this instance, is that it's set in Japan, and for the most part, it doesn't need to have been set in Japan. It could have been set anywhere, and I'm kind of okay with that. If Wes Anderson wanted to create kind of a sense of kind of otherness, or I don't know, exotic is a weird word that I don't like to use in that, because it kind of it smells like cultural appropriation. But unfortunately, this movie is straight up just culturally appropriating Japan.
Aye.
In the movie Lost in Translation, for example, they play Japan off as, you know, it's very different, and so none of the characters can kind of identify with it. There are a couple scenes where they do go a little too far, in my opinion, from a, like, we're playing Japan off for laughs. I would say in Isle of Dogs, in almost every instance, they're playing Japan off for laughs for the for why Japan is the setting for it. So I don't kind of agree with some of the stylistic choices also, because one of the major plot points is there's a character that is rallying to get the truth out of things and kind of shake up the game, and it's the one Caucasian character is saving the day in this kind of Japanese society, and I'm a little, I don't know how I feel about that. Although I really do know how I feel about that, I'm just trying to tamp that down so I don't swear.
I mean, that all checks out, Alan. That sounds like a movie to me.
Yeah.
I once wrote a blog post for I don't remember where it was posted, but it was called Two Brothers Who Are Not Brothers, and it was about Wes and P.T. Anderson and how they both kind of make movies in their very own particular, peculiar ways that are almost all of them about the same subject, which is families coming apart.
Mm-hmm.
Or the loose connections that we in today's society try to find to replace families, yeah, in a sense. And I've often thought back to, there were some good points in that one. I'm surprised that comparison hasn't been made more often or by better movie critics than myself.
Well, but you should link that to me if you find it, and then we'll post it.
Yeah, absolutely.
It should be a thing. Kind of continuing on the idea of things that maybe should be things. Brennan, you saw Ready Player One.
I did see Ready Player One. It's a movie.
Interestingly, I knew it as a book, and I read the book, and I was very displeased with it as a book. I knew a lot of people that were like, you should read this book. You're going to love it. You're a gamer. You're going to love it. And I'm a gamer. I am. I like playing games. I've been playing games since I could play games, right? In the ye olden times, I was playing the...
Insert decade here.
Right. I was definitely playing all of the games that he talked about. Zork, all the Atari 2600 games. I had an Atari 800, for criminy's sakes. These things, it was the game system from Atari that also had a keyboard associated, so you could use it to program. I was the super nerd, so I feel like my gamer cred is pretty good, and the book has kind of elements of that I think were very nice. But the thing that put me off the book, the thing that kind of honestly made me not want to see the movie, was that the book itself has just these long, drawn out set pieces where the narrator is just setting the scene, like not even doing anything, just setting the scene of how look at how many cultural references I can put into this one sentence kind of feel, which you know, would be distracting, because it would put me off of, like, I just want to see what's happening. I understand, you know, it's cool, but why is it cool? Give me more of the what's happening, not what it looks like. And so from the commercials, it looked like there is that aspect of it. There is that, like, nostalgia fest aspect of it, which I'm frankly getting burned off on in a lot of different ways. Like, we need to have new things. We don't have to necessarily rebuild all of the old things and reboot all of the old franchises. And when I saw the commercials for it, I was a little concerned, but I've heard very interesting things about it, and I wanted to hear your take.
I think you might actually like the movie, because all of those things from the book are gone. As it was just, I heard someone else describe it. It's like if someone explained the book to a person, and then that person told someone else the story, and they made it a movie. Like,
telephone.
They kept the characters, kind of. They even changed character names.
Okay.
They changed the characters. They changed the plot. They changed the entire, like, point, or not the. The message of the book is not the message of the movie.
Oh, interesting.
It is very different. So as someone who I actually really enjoyed the book, I listened to the audio version that Will Wheaton read, and I enjoyed that.
Interesting, because a side note on that is everyone that I've heard that has heard the audiobook really, really enjoyed it. But everyone that read it, or almost everyone that read it, like with their eyes, did not like it.
Yeah, so funny story, friend of the podcast, Skylar DeWitt, frequent guest.
Yes.
Maybe we'll have to have him back on soon. He couldn't finish the book. He hated it so much. He said he gave up like a third of the way through.
Uh-huh.
And then he went and saw the movie, and he really liked it.
Okay.
Huh. Whereas I liked the audiobook, and if I thought about the book at all, I hated the movie. But if while I was sitting in the theater watching this movie, I consciously tried to not think about the book.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was successfully able to do that, I actually kind of enjoyed it.
Okay.
Like, it was pretty good. It was better than most of the movies Steven Spielberg has made in the last, I don't know, 15 years. It was better than Crystal Skull.
Oh, God.
I'm puzzled by Steven Spielberg's love for Mark Ryland. Isn't that his name? The British stage actor?
Mm-hmm.
Who's been in the last four Spielberg movies or something like that. And I feel he's like a little bit shoehorned in. I don't know if he's... how is he doing in this one? Because in the first one he was in the spy movie. I thought he was excellent.
I actually thought he was pretty good in it. And he's playing an American. Like,
yes.
It wasn't who I envisioned when I was listening to the book. Mm-hmm. But I thought he did a good job with it. It was an interesting take. Same thing with Simon Pegg. The character that he portrays is nothing like the book, and nothing like what I envisioned. Even the leads in the book, the main character is a heavyweight guy, and of course in the movie he's not. Like, it's like we have a chance at representation, and no, taken away.
Right, that's really interesting. The virtual world gives way to how kind of Hollywood has to look. Right, I mean one of the key kinds of things in it is that you are playing like a, you know, virtual representation of yourself, so you can make it look like however you want. Except everyone in the actual world is beautiful. So there's no need to really worry about that in the virtual world. Okay.
It did have Ben Mendelsohn did a good job as playing the jerk bad guy.
Oh, like, I mean,
that's what he does now. Apparently.
He kind of does that. Yeah.
Yeah, he's good at it. And one of the highlights of the movie, TJ Miller.
No.
Yes. They created a character that wasn't in the book for him.
That's what I heard, yeah.
And it actually was pretty entertaining.
Okay.
I was like, oh, okay. Well, this is fine.
Excellent. Well, shifting gears at least one more time. We have at least two more to go here. Death of Stalin.
Yes, Armando Iannucci, one of my favorite current comedic writers.
Easily. I love Veep and In the Thick of It and everything he has done, actually.
I really enjoyed it. I laughed a lot. Steve Buscemi as Nikita Khrushchev is amazing.
It does sound like that would be pretty good. Yeah.
Jeffrey Tambor playing Jeffrey Tambor, because that's all he can ever do.
Right.
Michael Palin as Molotov. The two best casting choices and acting performances, I think, were Steve Buscemi and Jason Isaacs as Georgi Zhukov, the head of the Russian army.
Nice.
It's in that Python style of everybody has British accents, except Buscemi is Buscemi.
Yes.
That's what he's going to do. And it's funny, but it's also the most casually murdery comedy I've ever seen. Or maybe just movie I've ever seen. Like, there are so many people that get murdered in that movie.
Huh.
Well, now I want to see it even more.
It takes place, you know, right at the death of Stalin, obviously. Yeah. And, you know, at that time, there were lots of purges going on still in Russia, the Great Terror. And they portray all of that. And some of it for comedy and some of it not. But just in the casual case of events, just people getting shot left and right all over the place.
Hmm.
Yeah, it's a...
It's already on top of my to-see list, put it that way. So
I highly recommend
it. I'm very ready to watch that.
And then you saw one more that neither of us saw, which was... what is it? Is it really just called Blockers? Because, I mean, there's a...
It is just called Blockers, but in the logo it does have a rooster, also known as a cock.
Right.
Right in the beginning.
Hence.
Thank you for explaining that part.
It's a visual, yes. It's an auditory medium, so we have to do that for our listeners. I mean, it's
exactly.
It's only fair.
But it was produced by Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg.
It's usually a good thing.
Directed by Kay Cannon. She used to write for 30 Rock, and she wrote Pitch Perfect.
Nice. Which is good.
Just the first one, though.
She produced the other one. She didn't write the other ones.
The second one was not so good, and I haven't seen the third one yet.
But then it's an interesting story that's split. It's like set on prom night, and it's about three different teenage girls and their parents trying to interfere in their lives. And I'm not really spoiling much. Like, the girls make a pact to lose their virginity on prom night, and the parents find out about it, and then it's the whole night of them chasing them to stop them.
Hijinks ensue.
Yeah, the parents are played by John Cena, Ike Barinholtz, and Leslie Mann.
I cannot wait.
With Gary Cole in maybe his bravest performance yet. I'm not going to give away what happens.
Don't do it. Don't do it.
But it's a really funny movie. Like, it's got gross out humor stuff, but it also has an interesting story that's really relatable, and it rides the current wave of female empowerment that you're seeing more in movies today, which was nice. It almost kind of had a Superbad, like the female version of Superbad thing going for it.
Oh, okay. I like that idea.
But it was really funny. And I saw it with a couple people who we all three of us have different views on movies and different levels of comedy that we gravitate towards. And all of us liked it.
Okay.
Excellent.
So, yeah, no, it gets my full recommendation.
Hmm. We have been seeing a lot of movies, gentlemen. A lot of them.
Yes.
Movie Pass. Not a sponsor yet.
Get on it.
Yeah, right? Seriously, we really need a sponsorship up in here. But in the meantime, we will talk about... we have one more film to talk about, and it's one that we've all seen. And given that we've been on the air for minutes already... That's fine, because we're going to talk about this movie a bunch. Maybe not a whole lot, but we're definitely going to talk about
the movie. We're going to do it quietly.
We're going to be talking about A Quiet Place, which I finally saw yesterday. I think the two of you saw it at least last week?
Yeah, I saw it opening night.
Yeah.
Yep. I saw it Monday or Tuesday. Yeah.
And we are definitely entering spoiler territory.
Yeah, because I think you can only describe this movie by spoiling it.
Yes. So if you don't want to get spoiled, bye-bye.
I would say, before we start spoiling anything, let's reveal whether we recommend it or not.
All right. This is a professional one.
Okay, yeah. I think it's a thing. I thought it was great.
I agree.
I also think it's a thing.
Okay. Well, this is great because we didn't rehearse that.
Yeah, if you haven't seen it, stop listening now and go see it, and then come back and listen to this. But otherwise, yeah.
No, it's good. It's good. I thought there were so. I mean, it's a horror film. It's kind of sci-fi ish in that they actually have reasoning behind the bad big bad thing that's chasing everybody. The conceit that I think was interesting was that the big bad things hunt by sound. And this family has survived pretty much because the eldest daughter in the family is deaf, and so everyone was forced to learn sign language. So everyone is already in this mode of let's not be loud.
Except that one kid.
Oh, it wasn't his. Well, okay, it's nobody's fault, as the movie says. But it's an interesting conceit. It's an interesting kind of setup. It's rife with tense moments because, you know, you don't want to make a sound, right? You're that's the whole point. So the audience kind of empathizes with the characters automatically. There's a lot of kids in danger, so that's really kind of heart twisting.
Well, and they set the tone super early.
Yeah.
With, and again, we are in spoiler territory, so I don't feel bad. By killing a kid in the beginning, it makes the stakes real for those other kids because the movie's already established. We'll kill a kid.
Easily.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, there's a pregnant lady. She could die too.
Oh, my gosh.
With death by, was it Chekhov's nail?
Oh, yeah. Yep. Right. Although, to be fair, you know, Chekhov's shotgun does well. and I don't. We don't want to have to go right there, right this moment. But I mean, I think one of the nicest aspects of the movie was the sound design. I mean, it was really well done, emphasizing when they were kind of going into the point of view of that daughter, that they completely blanked out all the sound, and it would be just this very subtle like moment. It's like, oh, I can't hear anything now. It's not that it's very tense. It's that there's actually no sound happening when they're going into her point of view. There are some really interesting things with, without going too far into the like, oh, we're survivalists and we're living off the land and making this right. It's like, that's not, it's a we're surviving kind of movie without being, you know, so focused on that.
I do like that part that they didn't get into the details about how they knit their own clothes and harvest the corn and make 550 different recipes from it. I agree with the sound design. I really enjoyed the sound design, and especially after having seen A Wrinkle in Time a few weeks ago. Which,
interesting. That's on my list.
We have not talked about, but I'll give a spoiler point about it that I did not like, which is that I haven't read that book, so I mostly came out thinking, oh, that was a decent, good movie. My wife Cordelia has read the book and loved the book, hated the movie.
Oh, interesting.
One thing that Ava DuVernay in that movie does is that every time, it's like four or five times in the movie where there's a tense scene or a breakthrough scene of somewhere where in the regular old school movie, you would have an originally composed musical piece to fit that tension or situation.
Uh-huh.
She has a pop song that comes in and enters with lyrics and the singer and everything in there. And I'm like, I'm sure all of those songs individually are on the original soundtrack and on Spotify and Apple Music and everything. And that just felt like a marketing ploy gone to shits for me, because suddenly you have someone singing about something that takes you completely out of the process.
Hmm.
So everything I've seen since then, I've been hyper aware of the music in every scene. and especially in A Quiet Place, which is about a quiet place, and sound is so important to it. So every time there was music coming in, I was like, what's happening now? The music is there and the role that it's playing. And I thought they did it beautifully, and it wasn't too much and it wasn't too little. It was just perfectly balanced and added to the experience. And the other thing I want to say is that I'm fascinated by how every monster and bad guy these days seems to be inspired by the Stranger Things monster. And I feel like maybe you guys have seen something else that inspired that again. That's quite possible. But that's where I like saw that style of monster last or first, and how everything since then has been inspired by that. Because this one is for...
When we went and saw it, the first thing people were saying was, so this was Mars Attacks. Like, the ending is how Mars Attacks ends.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, I do love Mars Attacks.
Mainly the tall heads. Because it's not a happy ending movie either, is it? I mean, the guy dies, and we're in spoiler territory, and they look out the window, and there's like tons more shitheads coming running towards them.
But they're prepared.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Well, no, they've figured out at least a way to kill one of them. And so the theory is that they can use that again, and it ends on I don't know. I thought it was a very satisfying note where it ended. And I, you know, ending with the racking the shotgun, it's like, that's
badass.
That was just badass. I mean,
we know everyone can play a badass because we saw it in Live, Die, Repeat.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's not the name of the movie, but I know which one you mean. Yes.
But it is the name of the movie the comic. And then it was sort of the name of the movie in other markets, the way I understand it.
Really interesting.
Yeah, there was something. It didn't test well in the U.S., so they had to change it.
Yeah.
But I liked how it was a pretty tight story. Yeah. Like, I've seen versions of a movie like this where it's half an hour too long or an hour too long. And this felt like just the right length. It was like a movie version of a short story.
Yeah. It was 90 minutes. Yeah. It was right on the money, I think, time-wise. I think if there are things that kind of detracted from the movie, I mean, there is a bit of not a rhythm of like, okay, well, we haven't had a scare in a while, so let's do a thing.
There's a lot of jump scares.
You know, there were a lot of jump scares, which I think...
My arm hurt.
Yeah, I think the friend of mine that I went to see Arachnophobia with back in the day still has scars on her upper arm. It's not a movie I will ever see again.
But I think it was it was good, and it was tense, and it was the right amount of kind of tension for a lot of it. There are a couple of moments where it's like, oh, it's too much. It's just too much that this happens to this poor woman.
Yes.
It's talking like she steps on the nail and then has to give birth, and like then is trying to save the child in the basement as it's flooding, and it's like, oh my God, you gotta be kidding me.
I totally thought they were going to murder that baby with gas. I read that very wrong.
What do you guys feel? How do you guys feel about the Cloverfield connection or suggestion?
I'm glad they didn't.
Yeah.
Sorry?
I think it was strong enough on its own.
What?
There were conversations early on after this script came on the scene about how, because it's the same studio that does the Cloverfield landscape, or universe.
Yeah, yeah.
So there was talk of making this a Cloverfield movie, and I don't feel it's totally detached from that. I feel like if there was a link towards the end, or if they came out now and said like, this is actually the new Cloverfield movie, you'd still be like, yeah, I could see that happening. Or like the mood is a little bit of the same, but I think it has a more unique idea to stand on its own legs.
Oh yeah, it can absolutely stand on its own. It doesn't need to.
Doesn't need it, no. Besides, that latest Cloverfield movie, Up in Space, was a disaster.
Oh, I didn't see it. I decided.
Don't. But it came out on the Super Bowl.
This was produced by Mr. Michael Bay.
You know, I was gonna get to that. I was absolutely gonna get to that. I saw that come up in the credits, and I'm like, because he's in as a not as a producer credit, but as a casting credit first. And I'm like, huh? I wonder if that's the same Michael Bay. And then, sure enough, he gets the full big name producer credit, and it's like, oh, okay, all right, fine.
Yeah. But I thought Krasinski did a good job directing. I thought he was fine acting. Like, he wrote it, he directed it. It was good. Mm-hmm.
Have you seen the other two movies he's directed before?
No, but I saw the Rotten Tomato scores.
Oh, which ones are we talking about? I actually don't think I know.
I'm not sure you've heard of them. One is it's not Men Behaving Badly, but Conversation with Douchebags or something like that.
Okay.
Brief Interviews with Hideous Men.
Yes, thank you.
Okay.
That's the same as Conversations with Douchebags. Because the guy has a bag over his head in the poster.
Okay.
And then another one was, which is just like the classic first or second movie director by a little bit of an uncomfortable guy, where a guy from the big city comes back to the small town he grew up in to, like, either a high school reunion or a dying parent or one of those.
I have seen that.
That's
movie.
The plot. That's the plot of the movie. Yeah, maybe it's called Beautiful Girls last time I saw it. Yeah, The Hollers. Yeah,
it's got a great cast,
but not a great score. And by that, I don't mean music, but no. Like ratings.
No, it's got. I'm just looking at it right now. Charlton Copley, Charlie Day, Josh Groban, Richard Jenkins,
Josh Anna Groban. Kendrick,
I love everything Josh Groban does in movies and TV.
Oh my god,
Randall Park.
Okay.
I love the Randall Park.
Well, A Quiet Place was very good. I really enjoyed it.
I saw they were asked. A lot of people were like, "Why didn't they just remove the nail? What's with the nail? How can you just leave the nail there?" And then the producers were like, "Yeah, should we have just hammered it out? Is that your suggestion?" Like, I don't know. Gotten a hammer and knocked that thing through the stairs. What do you think? What would you do? Oh yeah. No, never mind. I get it now. But I'm sure there could have been. But I mean, it's not like they had a ton of time to contemplate and discuss this in between the moment where she pulls that nail up so that it stands in an upright position and until she stands on it. I think that happens within like half an hour of each other or something like that.
Good movie. Hopefully we'll have more good movies to come this year.
I liked it.
We'll certainly do our best to talk about them on the show. Again, thanks for listening to us for an hour now.
I'm wondering if adding the extra member to the podcast also has added another 30% to every episode.
I think that math checks out.
Well, if you would like to add another, I guess 25% to to an episode and be on a show, please do let us know. It's been great podcasting with folks, and I will talk to you folks next week.
Till next time.
Peace.